so mighty and merciful God, from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding, we humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. May we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for generations still to come. Amen. Meeting of Parliament, Monday, the 20th of September, 2021. Order of Proceedings. Oath of Allegiance. Confirmation of Minutes. The minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on the 20th, 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 26th, 28th, 29th, on 30th of July, 2021. May I find the minutes as correct? Communications from the chair. Petitions. Announcements. Papers to be laid. Report of committees. Answer to questions. I'm going to start the process again, and then Mr. Clark will read out the question once again. Question number 196 of 2021. The Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Mawon.
How many pay and display machines are there in Gibraltar, and out of this number, how many are working and how many accept card payments?
Answer beyond the Minister of Transport. Mr. Speaker, the time expression was submitted. 51 out of the 34 machines were working. All of the machines accept card payments.
Mr. Speaker, I have to say I find the answer very hard to believe because I myself am driving around quite often looking for parking and trying to use these machines, and I find that they don't work, a lot of them don't work, and the card payments are often not accepted, meaning that you have to call a number which delays things. So I asked the minister if he just took a snapshot, maybe one day sporadically on a convenient day that perhaps things were working for a few minutes, but I also received many representations on the matter. So can the minister give us a more detailed explanation of how, when they actually went out to answer, to get the information to answer this question, because it doesn't seem credible.
Speaker, I don't have that experience because I do my research. I do study in the places I work or live, but I am aware that in some occasions, in fact, in many occasions, these figures do fluctuate. And I have seen, even though I cycle and don't use payment services, I do have a keen eye. I work for, and especially if the paying those things like jackets. If you have a jacket over the machine, then clearly they're out of action. It's hard to spot the machines which are not, covered in that way. And there are issues which I'm trying to get to the bottom of, as the lady does alluding to. There are instances, in fact, there are many instances when machines may not work in their entirety. For example, one of the most common faults is failed to set a card. I'm digging into why it's happening. Apparently, it's really connectivity. And I like a mobile health device, which is moved around and it tends to pick up the connectivity. It's starting to see on code, will sometimes struggle with connectivity. Now, the company service that is responsible for these machines, company called Matrix, I met with him just last week and I did speak to him about these certain issues that we have, especially with the problem with these things, they take quite a bit of time, but it's not just the cards being read, that the line has to remain intact for long enough for the due to handshake to allow the transaction to take place. And that does take, you know, up to 30 seconds, or 15, 30 seconds. There was an interruption in that moment in time that there was a dip in the coverage, and there was an issue that has to start again. So those are the most prominent issues that we have. And this is why, as one of the ladies say, there is a sign on each machine saying that when you have difficulties, please call the office and they will charge you by phone to ensure that you have paid for your passing.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Honourable Minister, for his explanation. But given the stresses and the strains on the motorists arising from the lack of parking in Gibraltar and our desire to cater for tourists who do not have access to the zone parking, and given that paying display zones were an important part of the FCTP, are we not giving enough priority to the maintenance this company makes? Is the government satisfied with this company, or are they allowing it to sort of leave these machines fall into disrepair with leaving frustrated motorists, tourists having to spend several minutes on the phone in order to organise their parking? Does the minister not think that this is a matter of priority that should be maintained more regularly?
Speaker, this is exactly what I'm trying to get to the bottom of, because it may not be the machines per se, but it might be connectivity. And if it is connectivity, regardless of the brand or type of machine, and using those locations specifically, it may be impossible to maintain that area or that machine available for parking. What we are looking at, the contractor, the owner of the machine, we'll be looking at actually a survey of the area immediately surrounding the machine, because it may be just by moving the machine directly in the best location for users, so they don't have to walk too fast. So we've got the region point and the two machines, we try to get them in the field, so the walking distance is not huge. And sometimes it may be that place is not the best place for the user, because of buildings or interference or whatever. So they're looking at the area with the view of seeing whether feeling is stronger. And even if the person needs to walk more, which is the process here in the city, we can only get more parking terms and people in the policy and that respect, I think that may help. So I am looking into it, one person who wants to satisfy the bike because, like you say, the SEC says very clearly that if we pay on the screen, that we can give equities to people when we park. Either we get a security, a fast pay in given occasion, for days and months, or even weeks to end. And that's only if you're acceptable. I mean, through paying, where we can actually guarantee that my people have a right and the ability to use the kind of parking space that they need. So for me, it's extremely important that these machines are working. And I'm definitely satisfied, like I said. I look around it, and every machine that I see is not working, or every hoodie, and I will. It will tell me that they are. I mean, the time of the reply, I mean, I have checked to this. Yes, I've seen it sometimes. It's a fluid medium. Sometimes I'm sure it's more than 50 when you see the reaction. I'm sure that I can see that. I can see that. And then the complaints that come through, it is a great complaint for anything. Yeah? So it is important. And I am making sure and will make sure that that is such an important thing that needs to be, well kept as possible. I think this is the reply I see from the FCC when I ask the question. So if you want to put it on the screen, you get the up down to the moment in time. That is what I can do to provide one of the ladies with.
Thank you, Mr. Peters, for your indulgence. Can I just ask, given that the system, the FCCP and this parking machine system was a part of that, is there any solution? And these connectivity issues that could have been dealt with before these machines were put there, given this point to a lack of planning, as you call it, costing us money and inconvenience to citizens in Gibraltar or tourists to come in, and this has been done, has been dealt with beforehand.
I don't agree with that statement because I'm told you that these are people who are interfering from third parties. So what may be a good location at one given moment in time may turn out to be a bad location because of interference. So I think that's a step that these people need to work properly. We will need to perhaps that. You know, you look to see whether it is possible of moving around. That is really an interesting thing. I have this problem with the study to try to see what inclusion and matrix has. They have this issue apparently in the UK as well. See whether these antennas will increase, you know, the bandwidth so you can actually get better coverage to the machine. I will look at every single option. It is going to seem like failing, or if it's a brand that is failing, then obviously we have to make it seem to ensure that this is possible, we see that it's quite a different type of machine for the needs of the voter. But I cannot accept that this is something to do with bad planning, because, you know, we have to find convenient locations for the machines, and again, we have to find places. These are stolen machines. They take up, you know, light from the sun. So you may have maximum intensity and understood, and that location is not suitable for to pick up the solar power. So there's a number of things that we have to look at before we find the best location for the machine.
Honourable Edwin Mayer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So this is from part of this, I think the original part of the answer, was explaining that it unfortunately the machines have been able to take card payments for the many reasons we've given, but there's a phone number provided. Is the minister aware, as I'm telling from my own personal experience, that you don't always get a reply when you call that phone number? And could the minister please advise us what do we do when the machine does not read your card and you get no answer from the phone? What is going to do if the potential user or the paying party left it?
Yeah, I'm unable to see what happens when the bank goes out of the news for the second time after the first time. What I would not do, yes, I just had a dry lesson. We're speaking specifically about card payments. And if you are the interpreter of the machine, there is always the option for card payments. Not only in pounds sterling, but also in euros and also in. And that's then you have a free option. If you have this card payment in two denominations, there is card payment and there's also attendance in code number, and they should be there to pick up first. And I will most certainly take that up. So again, I'm not a payment free machine user, but I cycle everywhere now. So I circumvent all these issues that the other people face. But I understand that for me, it's very important that the machines are there for purpose. And they should be working on the system for the rest. So I really think that's a question.
Next question. Question number 197 of 2021. John E. J. Phillips and the leader of the opposition will be asking the question on his behalf.
Mr. Speaker, to the extent that there are questions of Mr. Phillips today, given that he's away in Belfast with other colleagues, I'll be asking him. Mr. Speaker, can the government confirm what support it is providing for the division of digital skills academy?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Digital and Financial Services.
Mr. Speaker, the government fully supports the development of the digital skills academy, and has been instrumental in enabling its establishment. The government notes and welcomes the Academy being nominated the finalist for the National Cyber Awards in the UK and congratulates Mr. Stuart Harrison on his excellent work with our students and his contribution to develop further learning and expertise in this important area.
Mr. Speaker, obviously we also welcome the establishment of the Digital Skills Academy. We'd like to know a bit more about what support the government is giving to the academy, and the minister says that they are supportive, and indeed we would expect this to be. And to what extent are they giving support, and of what nature is that support being given? The academy, when it was launched, I think it was in August this year, talked about trying to have education and partnerships and partnerships with the private sector. We could also facilitate grants, and again, perhaps it would be helpful to know the extent of sector who's in the
event. Mr. Speaker, the Spanish Foundation was facilitated by our friend, the Minister of Education, appointment to Harrison. Phil Harrison has now, for a 6 year of time, been seconded to the Digital Services Ministry in order to enable him to have the time to put what he needs to put into this. So he's doing work for us, but also for the Digital Skills Academy. The conditions that my only friend put on Mr. Harrison at the time was that it really cost them the money to have the Digital Skills Academy set up. And that's in fact what's happened. So Mr. Harrison and the Academy have gone out and found financial support from the private sector, as well as accommodation from the private sector at no cost to government or the Academy itself. So we think it's a wonderful thing to be able to upscale cultural variation and some of the work that Mr. Harrison has done over these past years is testament to that. And indeed, we will also have the ability to have him within the Digital Services Ministry working precisely in the area in which he is supporting the teaching education of, namely cyber and everything digital. So he's an enormous asset for us to have. We're going to see how it goes and how it develops over the next 12 months. The Academy clearly works with students outside CI primarily, and so it fits very nicely. We prepared to put in the time and effort required to make a success of both aspects of the plan of what is the Digital Education.
And it's helpful, we have to help them in part because really all I can do is supporting things like making time available for some people to know. Is the government providing financial support to the economy, for example? So that would be in the nature of the question that I was asking. And does the minister agree with me that really this is such an important issue, the whole issue of the repositioning of our digital skill set. It's such an important issue that this is something that goes beyond the issue of support, that while of course that the government should support the initiatives such as this, that it should be a policy of priority for the government to ensure that we remain competitive in the new technologies and new industries and that it has a vested interest to not just in supporting it, but in going beyond that into ensuring it does all it needs to do so that our economy can be competitive up to the future in terms of the skills of the potential employees.
We believe this is extremely important, and for that reason, it's supported it in its early stages of growth in the past year. I think the evidence of that is in what has happened these past 5 or 6 years since Mr. Harrison, from the Ministry of Education, began his work in enhancing. Not just knowledge and expertise, but understanding of what the opportunities were for people in digital skills. And the number of prizes that we've won with our schools is recognition of the fact that in the answer that I give, you will know that the Academy has already been shortlisted for other awards in the United Kingdom, which I hope that he will do well. And the digital recognition of what he's done and the time that he's done it is really quite extraordinary. But to think that in respect of the question of whether there's value in funding to the Academy, meant to say, when I mentioned that the Ministry of Education has put the position of the city cost government money, because he is 100% privately funded. So he's got funding from the private sector, both in respect of capital and in respect of rental accommodation from their base. So the government support is to enable the person driving it to have the time to go to do it. That's why it's been seconded from the Ministry of Education to the Ministry of Digital Services, precisely to be able to take up this work and really give a boost to the rest of the government past year, which I have every confidence that the people can work.
Finally, Mr. Speaker, can I just ask about the scope of in the interaction that the government is having with the digital skills economy? I ask, what's the government understanding as to the scope of the Academy's work? There has been talk of cybersecurity, both when it was launched and indeed I think the Minister mentioned it, and we believe that possibly a way could be put up to it. And it's well known that they've done work over the last few years in relation to that, but is the work of the academy in the structure of that area, or is it a wider kind of digital skills work that they're doing with kind of deployed in other areas of industry and for example, some services or in analysis?
The scope is extraordinarily wide, and it is wide because it is not being set by us in government. This is Mr. Harrison identifying the areas that he believes will be a benefit to students. Obviously, depending on the age that you bring a student into the academy, will dictate the nature of the learning that that child is going to be undertaking. Therefore, what he is doing with his eyes and teaching is to set different scopes of work for different ages. Then right back through to the work that we're doing with us in the morning, if I can call it outside the academy, in terms of some real cyber security support work for government and its own system.
Next question. Question number 198 of 2021. The Honourable Chair Sopardi.
Can government provide a breakdown of which districts have suffered unplanned power cuts since the 1st of January 2017, stating the number of power cuts and their approximate duration in each case and the apparent cause?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Digital and Financial Services.
Mr. Speaker, the answer to the question is only question 199.
Question number 199 of 2021. The Honourable K.F.
Mr. Speaker, are government considering any improvements to the electricity infrastructure given that power cuts have suffered from time to time?
Answer, beyond the Minister for Digital and Financial Services.
Mr. Speaker, the government having inherited creaking infrastructure through the devotion of city authorities, are constantly investing in new infrastructure and cabling throughout its network, with a view to modernizing and continuously improving the network and the associated equipment to safeguard the resiliency of our power supply. The timing of this building program is designed to cause minimal disruption. The information required by the honourable member is set out in the schedule that I now hand to them.
Mr. Speaker, I am really grateful for the schedule of the honourable member just handed us, and I will, as I stand, look through it and ask supplementaries that I think is relevant, but it may be that we need to come back to this issue in due course once we study the details. But just from a cursory look at this, it's obvious that there have been more than 30 power cuts since the 1st of January 2017, and while the only member talked about creeping infrastructure, the reality is that it's been nearly 10 years since the government has took office, and the number of power cuts in the last few years has been significant. You can see 14 in 2019, and another 6 in 2020, and 7 in 2021, although
are of different lengths, but certainly there are power cuts that range from a few minutes to over 2 or 3 hours. So is the minister saying that all of that, and I can see from the reasons for them, that not all of that is related to a rollout of investment in the network? They are obviously related to various causes. So what can the minister say about it?
I think there are always different reasons as to why we have power failures. From the start, from the record that we all have, we see that we have traditionally generation failure, lack of power, because of something that's happened in the station, network failure on the grid, somewhere on the line, some of that creeping infrastructure has failed. It could be a building contractor drilled through the cable, causing a power failure, which there is that here too. And one of the new reasons is software failure, and it's new because there was no software in the previous system, by comparison to what we have today. So the reasons for the power failures vary significantly. And the infrastructure that we have, which we are now rolling out to rebuild over the next year, will deal with high voltage, low voltage substations, as well as the interconnection system between them. So to do with the one is to do with speed, and many of the times the failures occur through no fault of generation. But again, even in generation, when you build a new power station as we have, which is new and innovative, this is not like a car, which is start and it shouldn't fail. Generation systems of this complexity and this size will have teething problems, will have issues. And these go on for some considerable period of time. You only remember to know that we have a company operating these power stations for the first 12 months. Precisely in order to help us to deal with the teething problems that we are expected to encounter, and indeed are encountering. So nobody should be surprised that it's going to take us some time to get to a situation where we have less and less of these power stations. In terms of power generation, one of these issues or items that the GA is finally considering. So, if you look at one of the systems of power generation, we are looking at the option of having basically a live battery, which will withstand for a period of time if there is a power failure in 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 sets. And it would basically give you enough time to restart the particular engine if it went possible, and it would also help to stabilize the power supply that it is indeed welcomed by the majority of users. So, a whole host of reasons as to why and how these things happen, but as far as I'm told by the GEA, who are the experts, that what we are experiencing this year, and since the commencement of operation of the new facility, is very much anticipated, expected, and desired.
Mr. Speaker, obviously I can see from the column and indeed the honourable member's explanation that indeed the reasons for various power cuts are wide ranging. I mean, they go from technical issues to human error, meaning there's some of those, and some faults of cables or that increasing fix that you don't get an explanation beyond that as to the cause of the fix, but that is something systemic in which is related to the infrastructure or whether it's a particular reaction to something else in the structure. Yes, there is an explanation, but it's an abbreviated explanation, which is that unless you're a technical electrical engineer, it would be difficult to understand what causes specifically related to that and whether it's related to the infrastructure or not. But the question I have for the honourable member is that given that there are a number of these power cuts that have been happening every year, does the electricity authority analyse when power cuts happen, whether the fault is something that is, if I can call it, light technical, or whether it's something that requires an infrastructure improvement? is that an ongoing process that we refer to ongoing?
Every time there's a power cut, the DEA are required to know and understand what caused it. And indeed, in some of the instances during my time with responsibility of the DEA, this has been a significant amount of work. But of course, they are simply not going to put the power on, and this has never happened to them. If on every occasion there is a power cut, the full investigation carried out by the DEA. Some kind of recycling has happened to ensure, as far as possible, that it will not happen again. And that's exactly what we do. Yeah.
Next question. Question number 215 of 2021, the Honourable E.J. Reyes.
Mr. Speaker, can government provide details of the number of students currently enrolled at St. Martin's School with a breakdown of age ranges?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for the Environment and Education.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, Mr. Speaker, I now hand over the schedule with the information requested.
Next question. Question number 216 of 2021, the Honourable E.J. Reyes.
I'll interject
for a moment. If the Honourable Mr. Reyes is a proper supplementary, and the Honourable Mr. Reyes is a supplementary to make, then by all means, I can do so. But this has to do it immediately, we can continue with the rest of the question. Is that acceptable? Let's continue with question 216.
Thank you for that, Mr. Speaker. Yes, I mean, all I need to do is really add up the total number of things you need to arrange to provide again paper. But I'm very grateful for the reference to something done to step up from that. On 216 specifically, Mr. Speaker, can government provide details of which vocational courses have been delivered at our schools for the academic year 2021-2022, together with details of the number of students following these courses, the vocational establishment delivering the courses, the completion date of the courses, and the qualifications obtainable upon successful completion of said courses?
Answer, beyond the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, there are a total of 18 students who will complete their Level 2 Care and Duty course delivered at Westside and Bayside Schools this academic year. An additional 9 from Bayside and 7 from Westside are expected to complete the same course next year. We have 78 students at Bayside and 23 students at Westside who will complete their Level 2 Digital Technology qualification at the end of this academic year. A further 24 students from Bayside and 3 from Westside are expected to complete their Level 2 Digital Technology qualification in 2023. We must not forget that we also have 85 students at our comprehensive and 377 students at the Devoto College who are following courses which are vocationally assessed. They are in subject areas which are not traditionally considered as vocational subjects, but are being assessed in a vocational manner. This includes the 4 students who are now working towards their new music performance qualification, which was introduced this year. The number of students does not include those students who at some point in their journey are completing award scheme development and accreditation network qualifications, which are vocationally assessed at our comprehensive schools. And I, in order to assist further, I now hand over a schedule with a breakdown of the information requested.
The Minister of Education and the Speaker said that there were also courses that had some type of repair, like traditionally the facing the effect. Are those, because I don't know what level, are those here in the start or those are over above? Because he could have been referring to the four students of the college who are under the heading of music performance. And if that is the case, it doesn't tell me whether it's a level 1 or level 2 type of qualification, could even be a level 3, which is equivalent to your level. I'm not certain what standard of level qualification that would be.
The speaker, for level 3, it's a no-level equivalent.
Honourable Damon Bettino.
Can I go back to the Honourable Minister's answer to question 515? My total is 92, I'm not sure that's correct, but I've passed by colour as far as I've written it to a sense. Can I ask him whether he satisfied that the new school is sufficient size to cater for this number of children? And is he considering, at what stage does he consider that he's not so satisfied that there may be a requirement to build further floors and expenses that cause in order to cater for what is clear, a rising number of children who need this certain facility?
The school is adequate at present. There is clearly an increase in the number of children who are being identified. Not all the children who are in essentially early birth, which is a nursery section, age 2 and 3, will necessarily continue as in nursing because some of those after assessment and after assistance are likely to go into mainstream schools. But we have to keep an eye on this. If the number continues to be on the increase, then clearly we will have to assess that can come ahead for the next 5 or 10 years. At the moment, we are fairly comfortable, but clearly the much higher number of children who are coming this year is something that we have to keep an eye out on.
And does he have a number for maximum capacity for that school? Is that available to him, beyond which it would become now on impossible to cater for children above that number?
I would have to consult on a specific number.
We have just one final question.
I think I was referring to it because I think my colleague has been asked this question as well as a few. Some minor thing has popped up in the reply to the schedule and it's a very major question to 116. Is that the most of the value? I think minor qualification on the part of the Gibraltar College, there are 20 students due to complete in 2022. The award in health and social care, but it says in brackets level 1 to 2. It could either be level 1 or level 2 because there are two completely different curriculums that are being delivered. You know, it's not one of those things that you follow up course. Level 1 has a set curriculum and level 2 has a set. So I don't know if the students are aiming towards level 1 or level 2.
I think it's because they actually have the option of continuing to level 2, and the distinction isn't made here, but I will check, and I'm very happy to to provide that information to the honourable member.
Thank you, Speaker. That was definitely, I do understand it makes a bit of sense, but if they do continue to level two, then the end date will probably be a year later. So, you know, for a record and for education, this clarification, I'd be grateful if they could eventually give us information.
Next question. Question number 217, 2021, the Honourable E.J. Taylor.
Can government provide details of the number of new mandatory scholarships which have been granted and commencing during the 2021-2022 academic year?
Answer, beyond the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Speaker, the government has granted 217 new mandatory scholarships. The process is still ongoing and this number is expected to increase over the next few days. And Speaker, some students are still processing their documentation and so on, so it is likely that there will be at least a few more coming up shortly.
And obviously, Speaker, my question was of a new mandatory scholarship year, but I'm not correct in saying that students still have an option of not necessarily taking up their offer for a mandatory scholarship at the start of this academic year, but they could delay for a year. That is available then they still get to the floor next year. In the same manner, I haven't asked it, but the minister might be aware. There could be students who are taking up this year now what could have been taken up as a mandatory scholarship last year. If he ever does come across the issue, it would be interesting for statistics purposes to help.
I think I don't have those details. It is possible to take a gap year. Normally, the students would advise the Department of Education this year about them wanting to take a gap year, and then that would be considered, and it would normally be allowed at that level.
Next question. Question number 218, 2021, the Honourable E.J.
Can government say, can government say how many new applications for discretionary scholarships were received for the academic year 2021-2022, and if these, how many were A, successful applications after original applications, 2, successful applications after appeals lodged by the applicants, and 3, not successful at all, together with reasons why?
Answer, the Honourable for the Environment, the Honourable Minister for the Environment and Education.
I think I would answer this question together with questions 225 and 226.
Question number 225 of 2021, the Hon. Ms. M.D. Hassan Naum.
Of the discretionary grants received, how many were successful on appeal?
Question number 226 of 2021, the Hon. Ms. M.D. Hassan Naum.
Can government provide a list of discretionary grant applications by subject for which funding has been sought, followed by which applications were approved, declined, and in the case of unsuccessful applications, what reason was given for refusal?
Answer, Leon, the Minister for the Environment and Education.
The figure, a total of 216 applications for discretionary scholarships were received, 141 applications were successful as per their original application, an additional 39 were funded upon appeal. 26 applications were not funded. 4 of these applications were from individuals who did not meet the eligibility criteria. Another 4 applied for a program which would not be funded by the discretionary process. The unsuccessful included requests for funding for the 3rd degree or for courses to be taken sometime after completion of the previous degree or for a subject unrelated to the original degree. I now hand over the schedule with the information requested.
Mr. Speaker. Can I understand a little bit more from the Honourable Minister when the applications are originally get declined and then they get approved second time round? Where is let's say at the beginning there is no funding for the extra students, which then make the grade to be funded? If there's a funding cap originally, how does government overcome that funding cap, or does it have an allocated amount of funding in order to provide for the second time applicants who have initially been declining? How does the budgetary policy on this work, Mr. Speaker?
The funding is set here. The funding is set here in Parliament during the budget session. And then we have an independent panel which considers the application and ranks them. And the first consideration clearly is in relation to the funding available. And then those that appeal are then considered on the merits to see whether there is cause for creating for making that available. And clearly, supplementary funds would be required for us to be able to fund those students.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Minister for that answer. I'd like to ask him if perhaps, given the sentiments that arose from so many disappointed students this year and the poor timing in which they were given these news, would the Honourable Minister agree that there could have been more done by way of support, and that perhaps they will try and change their timing next year so that students don't get left on the lurch in the last week of August, as they did this year, which causes a lot of issues and heartache for them and logistical nightmares?
Part of the delay was precisely in terms of certainty how we could find as many as we possibly could. But I have already asked the new Director of Education to work with me in reviewing the process to ensure it is streamlined and effective and efficient as for next year.
Honourable Edmund Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If you can return to the schedule the Minister has handed out. He said that in answer to my question that 26 applicants have not been successful. In this schedule, he lists the subjects that have been approved, and there's only 8 identified as not being successful, mainly for reasons of either the applicant did not meet the eligibility criteria or that the chosen course did not meet the necessary criteria with respect to the level of qualification. That is what he said, because it was below a bachelor's degree level, and that didn't meet that. But that only accounts for 8. There are missing. I know he mentioned that at some stage that one applicant seems to have been application for a third degree, but that does not make him ineligible. That was probably because of the discussion award. The board may have decided to not send it further. But I'm missing that information from this answer.
Madam Speaker, the whole member has looked at the third column. There is in the second column a larger number of declined. The explanation specifically hasn't been given. They fall under the 3 categories that I mentioned in my answer. Third degree, time after completion, or an unrelated subject. The reason why they haven't been specified is because they've also been a smaller degree. If you look at the reason, and then you look at the subject, you're going to identify the person. If you want me to go into further details, I'm happy to do that behind the chair. But those that are declined without announcing the third column fall under the categories in the main text of my answer.
Madam Speaker, yes, it does make sense. May I just very humbly suggest, Mr. Speaker, because the Minister can facilitate a lot of examples in drawing the figures. However, the size of the contract, for those of us, I think, Mr. Speaker, you can perhaps emphasize with the young member himself, those of us who are in midway to our 60s and have sort of really good degrees, could the front of the sentence be slightly larger, Mr. Speaker, to facilitate our reading, to specify reading glasses, we do struggle a little bit. And then Mr. Speaker, also on a serious note, the Minister just mentioned something which I wanted to get to. He said now that the possible reason could be the length is referring to the gap between when the individual graduated and asking for the discretionary. Is it a rule or is it discretionary that is a certain length time, you know, like how far for them that applicant becomes automatically ineligible? So can you clarify a bit on that point?
I think that the second part is discretionary, and that is the first on a case-by-case basis. On the first, being more into my mid-60s than he is, Mr. Speaker, I do struggle, but I manage because I'm so excited to take my glasses off and bring my paper closer, but I do understand exactly what he's referring to. And so there's so much information that the honourable member requests, Mr. Speaker, that I don't want to use reams and reams of A3 paper, or A1 paper even, in order to reply, but I take his point. Thank you very much.
You have a good review of the opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I ask just to pick up a point that the Honourable Minister said about a couple of answers ago, which is that I think I took an accurate note that supplementary funds could be requested to fund those additional students that had on appeal been successful, and there's quite a few. I think statistically, there were about 64, presumably, of people who potentially could have appealed, and 39 were successful. I don't know if everyone appealed, but certainly 39 of the 64 remaining were successful. I had assumed, I have to say, that when the original process had been carried out on a sort of merit assessment basis by the independent panel, they would approve who they thought was merited to obtain it. In accordance with the EU, they would be subject to the financial cap in case of the budget, but that it wouldn't be their very last penny that they would be spending. But the way that the Minister answered suggested that there was a large proportion of the additional successful applicants might have to require supplementary funding. Is that the case? As I understood it, and if so, has the Minister of the Department been able to cut the supplementary funding that would be required to fill in there?
Mr. Speaker, this engages my public finance responsibility. What the appeal process identified, Mr. Speaker, was that a lot of people have been rightly rejected by the panel as applicants for discretionary services, because actually they should have applied for mandatory services. They were not activated for discretionary services, although those were the boxes that had been ticked. And therefore, there had to be an allocation of a large number of, and I can't give you the number of which are on my feet, but a large number of those will be funded through the mandatory participation column. Because that's what the appeal process identified. Some of the rejections were because this is not a discretionary application, it's a mandatory application. And the person is told that they are rejected as a discretionary applicant, but then they are advised that actually they are granted mandatory applicants. And therefore, the column that provides under the Department of Education the spending for mandatory applicants will have to change also. Honourable members will know that that is a demand-led column. So the best that we can do in terms of estimating is look at the average of numbers who have had the mandatory scholarships the year before and extrapolate that forward, and that will obviously fluctuate. Now, I believe that that is the one, actually, that is the column that is going to rise the most. That, Mr. Speaker, will be affected by the mechanisms that we have in place this year for A-level results, which have not been examined, have been a teacher-led assessment. It will be affected by those who are covered by our policy of granting a first master's as a mandatory scholarship, and indeed of continuing to grant those who seek professional qualification to bring into effect their first degree also as mandatory application. So that affects that calculation. You're then left, Mr. Speaker, with a number who ask what one might describe proper applications for discretionary scholarship. So I can't tell you as the government how that column will change in terms of funding.
Well, we said supplementary here, I think that is a term of art. There may be some wiring between the head and education, and less supplementary, but as honourable members know, that is something that we've done at the level of controlling officers who will decide whether they need to wire or keep supplementary, depending on how their numbers are developing in any particular financial year. Grateful for that answer. It's helpful to that extent. I think the people have said that he doesn't know how many of the 39 were people who really should have applied for money. But perhaps, given that we're discussing that, either he or the minister could revert to ask once they coalesce around the numbers, the specific numbers, how many of those 39 were really people who could have applied for mandatory. And would be granted that. And then, secondly, if someone can help me on this basis, as I understood the process, there is a system being done, presumably by an educationalist, some kind of panel in the education department, they then go to an appeal. The appeal presumably is a separate body, which contains different people, but again, I'm asking, I don't know. And is it that it's different people who's on each of the bodies? I'm not asking for specific names, but can we have an idea of who's on it? And then thirdly, if some of the 39 should have really applied for mandatory awards, and the first tier contains educationalists, why wasn't that offered at that stage?
The original assessment is carried out by the scholarship panel, which includes some relatively junior members of the, I say relatively junior members of the Department of Education, plus three independent members, but with a certain academic background. And the appeal is then done by senior members of the Department of Education. And I think that there has been some confusion in that. In the past, the masters have been dealt with as discretionary and not as mandatory, and that's where the confusion has been. And this is why I said to Honourable Lady, I've asked the new director to completely review the process so that everything can be clear and we have absolutely clear guidelines to make sure that this doesn't happen next time.
Next question. Question number 219 of 2021, the Honourable E.J. Bailey.
Can government say how many new applications for distance learning scholarships were received for the academic year 2021-2022? And are these how many were A, successful applications as per original applications, B, successful applications after appeals logged by applicants, and C, not successful at all, together with reasons why.
Answer, the Honourable, the Minister for the Environment and Education.
The Speaker received 31 new applications for distance learning awards, 16 were successful as per their original application, one additional application was funded upon appeal, 14 applications were not funded.
Yeah. Can the Minister add something that person said that those are not successful, that you have any sort of general reason why, as he did for the previous question?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. So, there were a number which were not considered eligible and others which were beyond the allocated budget for distance learning.
Next question. Question number 220 of 2021. Leon K. Afropardi. On behalf of the Hon. E.J. Phillips.
Speaker, can the government state that it will be removing the green wall of St. Anne's and Notre Dame School and replacing them the same with anti-Pacific planting?
Answer, the Honourable, the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Speaker, I'm not really sorry that the Honourable Mr. Phillips
is unclear because the answer this week is no, sir. I would really like to know how it occurred to him that was even the remotest possibility, Mrs. Speaker.
Next question. Question number 221 of 2021. The Honourable Claire Sofardi on behalf of the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Speaker, can the government state the name of the company which provided the fees for the new Midtown Park?
Answer, the Honourable, the Minister for the Environment and Education.
The figure of fees for the Midtown Park were provided by DJVS as a main contractor for the project.
Therefore, Mr. Speaker, DJVS presumably obtained them from someone, and I'm going to show which we can do that.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, they were sourced via long-form consultants who are the designers of the park and indeed designed Commonwealth Park, and they were sourced via Majestic Trees, is the name of the company, and the olives and the cork came from Barcelona, and the remaining trees came from Lyon.
Mr. Speaker, Majestic Trees is a Spanish entity, and you're asking Majestic Cube is presumably not a Gibraltar entity, and these trees should not be sourced via a Gibraltar operator, and why would that be?
Well, Mr. Speaker, in Gibraltar, these trees are very high quality, they are very mature. I know this market well, I used to work in it for 20 years. It's not possible to obtain that quality of trees, certainly anywhere in the surrounding area, and they were first. Yes, they were first by DJVS, absolutely. They were first by DJVS. There's nobody in the world there who can grow these trees, right? They didn't have a space. And secondly, we had to ensure that we had the best quality trees available.
Mr. Speaker, I'm sorry to hear the Honourable Member say that. We cannot obtain such high quality trees in Gibraltar. That must be a real dismay to the Honourable Member, given his track record as someone who works in this industry, who has got a track record as an environmentalist. Speaker, from his position, someone with knowledge in the area, why were these particular trees sourced, given that they may be difficult to grow here?
I'm not nervous to speak up. We wouldn't be able to grow them here, and the reason why I said that is because we don't have the space to grow mature trees as a nursery. We just don't have the space. Those trees, if he happens to have walked through Commonwealth Park any time recently, he would have seen how well the trees do. But they had to be obtained elsewhere. The ones in the town, the part of Midtown, will equally do very, very well. Some of them might not, there's always a slight percentage loss. But they have to be sourced from a reliable source, and that is simply not available here. But, as we were saying earlier, sourced by a devoted company.
Next question. Question number 222 of 2021, the Honourable Claire Sopalvi.
Mr. Speaker, have jellyfish nets been removed from beaches, and if so, which beaches, and what is the government's policy on their replacement?
Answer, the Honourable, the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, all the jellyfish nets have not been removed. They are placed every year, and indeed we added one on the north side of Eastern Beach in 2019. One net was removed from Catalan Bay on the 24th of July because the shallowness of the sea this year resulted in it not being possible for the net to be properly anchored. This resulted in it repeatedly becoming detached, thus proving a significant safety hazard.
I'm not sure the Honourable Member has answered. Perhaps he can volunteer an answer when he rises again. As to the guns policy and their replacement, is there an ongoing programme in respect of the replacement? Is the government committed? Is the government committed to ensure that jellyfish nets are placed in each of the relevant features? Will there be an ongoing programme of maintenance? And as one has been removed in Catherine Bay, will the government commit to ensure that it is replaced in a good way in future?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. These jellyfish nets were introduced by this government. We have continually maintained them. We have increased the number, and we will continue to replace them. As I explained this year, because of the shallowness of the sea, there wasn't enough weight for them to be anchored down, and they were coming loose with a slight swell and was a danger. But of course, they would be maintained as they are regularly, and if any to deteriorate, they will be replaced. The number of jellyfish in the sea, sadly, because of the trend due to climate change, continues to increase, and carefully vindicates this policy.
Mr. Speaker, was the fact that it had to be replaced in Catherine Bay anything to do with the lack of maintenance of the jellyfish nets? And does the minister, has the minister got any kind of sense of the cost of the maintenance program of the jellyfish nets and their establishment in particular?
Mr. Speaker, as you still have notice of that question, if I'm going to go into a break on a question. The jellyfish net was removed from Catherine Bay because keeping it there, floating about, roaming about, could have resulted in a child, an elderly person, a non-elderly, non-child person getting entangled and drowning. So it was a health and safety measure. The maintenance is done regularly by local people with specialist support, and we are committed to continue to have this.
Next question. Question number 223 of 2021. The Honourable Sarah Kopali.
Mr. Speaker, what discussions with commercial parties have there been, and what commercial opportunities has government been approached on or is considering in relation to an additional cannabis?
Answer. The Honourable, the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar has been approached by two different commercial entities in respect of establishing a regulated industry for the production, import, export, marketing, and sale of cannabis for medicinal purposes. Government's plans in respect of this innovative and potentially thriving sector of Gibraltar's economy are set out in Express Release 582/2021 and in the published Medicinal Cannabis Bill. As a full heard, Mr. Speaker, that Honourable Members' offices will support the government's firm commitment to back the efforts of the private sector in establishing the appropriate legal and regulatory architecture that creates a medicinal cannabis industry robustly regulated to the highest of standards.
Mr. Speaker, that unfortunately gives us very little information in respect to the question that I actually asked. Apart from giving us information on that there are two entities that they have been approached from, where I asked the question of what discussions have there been, what commercial opportunities have government been approached from. The government has said that it has been approached by two entities, but has not given us, in the Minister's answer, specifics about the actual opportunity in respect of the medicinal cannabis industry that those entities are discussing. So can I ask the Minister to perhaps give us a bit more detail about the precise opportunity that those entities have approached the government on? Can I also ask him, these two entities, are they Gibraltar entities? Or Gibraltar established entities, and are the beneficial owners of these entities residents and visitors?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is asking a very specific question about a very specific area of policy, medicinal cannabis. The Honourable Gentleman has asked how many people have engaged with us in respect to this particular policy area. We've told him it's true. He's asked us what it is that they want to do in that area that they've approached them. And the answer to the Speaker, I think, seems so glaringly obvious that to do the thing which is revealed before the Parliament will permit if the Parliament passes the bill. So it's very difficult to see what the Honourable Gentleman thinks we have been approached on, which would be beyond the risk that may go from this Parliament if we pass the bill. And now, we presented the bill, the government bill, and therefore the way it's going to be passed, so it may be amended, Mr. Speaker, etc. And that is what we have been approached on. My ministry has been involved with the Ministry of the Honourable Gentleman because there are potential public finance aspects to this, duties, etc., to people, to be of interest, and to the public press. What each of them is talking to us about, and how each of these entities, or indeed other entities in future, may risk the respect with the government, would have to be confidential because it's commercially sensitive to each of them. In other words, one may come with one proposal to do things in one particular way, which is their way of doing things in its propriety, and this way another. And so, discussing across the floor of the House, before the bill is even an act, what it is that we may or may not be able to see established as a service of industry in Jakarta is very, I think, so not to create a hostage for fortune, which may not enable us to do those things better. I'm very happy to have a discussion with the Honourable Gentleman and tell him what I know, and the Honourable Gentleman has a happy saying that he knows, about what it is that these entities are proposing, but we don't think it would be fair to air publicly what has been put to us by two entities, which may affect their ability to do it, or that there are competition issues here, etc. So, the Honourable Gentleman can rest assured that there's nothing proposed that is outside what would be proposed by the existing legislation before the House is built, and I'm very happy to give him a heads up privately whilst we have coffee, if he wishes. But I think going into those discussions publicly now would not would potentially mean that those discussions will not flourish. And he, no doubt, wishes to see the government's discussions with these entities flourish if there is a law that provides for their business to be done properly in the public. Mr. Speaker, I'm happy to have that conversation with the Honourable Member. I don't think it's, as you put it, glaringly obvious, because the bill that we can discern what they want to do from the bill before Parliament, because the bill before Parliament, you will appreciate, and I make this promise, is a very widely drawn bill. It would allow a number of things to happen, and really, what I was seeking to ask in my question is, of all the number of things that the bill would provide, if it is made law, presumably, these parties might be talking about doing everything under the sun as provided for by the law, or maybe actually asking about something extremely specific. And without revealing commercial confidences, is it possible for the government to let us know the specific nature of the proposal? If the answer that the Honourable Member has given is no because of commercial confidence issues, then I'm happy to have the conversation with him. The answer is that we won't get into specifics, but if the answer of the government is that wide and drawn, in other words, from a helicopter view, what type of business is it that has been approached to do, then the answer has been given. I mean, the argument, Mr. for Digital Services, that draws my attention to the fact that we have said in the first answer that the two different commercial entities have approached us to establish a regulated industry for production, import, export, marketing, and sale of medicinal cannabis. So, if we wanted to know whether they were widely drawn proposals, whether they were narrow proposals in discrete areas, then I think we've given him the answer. I think I still remember that the last time the coffee was in the room talked about last night, this weekend football, which is particularly good for my answer.
the Honourable Marlene to stand down?
Speaker, if I may ask the Honourable Minister, at what point in the last few years did these commercial discussions start to take place? Because from what I remember, I put a motion to Parliament on medicinal cannabis 4 years ago, and it was retinely let down by the entire House, was voted against it. So, from my understanding, not in a commercial frame of mind, it could have been helping many people since 4 years ago. So I'd like to know, at what point did the government do a U-turn on that, the manifestation that it wasn't a good idea? At what point did it start becoming a good idea and these commercial discussions start taking place?
From the people that's not the position of it. If the Honourable Lady seeks to make memory and look back at the terms on which her motion was rejected, it wouldn't reflect the things that she has said now. It's actually quite different, and this is not a question of U-turn, but actually ensuring that what we do is in keeping with what we consider to be in the best public interest of the voter, and not simply supporting a widely drawn motion which was at the time seeking to, in our view, jump on the bandwagon of something that appears to be popular to her. And you know, frankly, this is a very sensitive area of policy which will engage also importation and exportation, importation of some aspects of sometimes potentially of seeds or potentially of dried leaves, some exportation of seeds potentially, exportation of oils, all of which has to be done in a very controlled manner, and it is quite different to the things that the other lady was in her motion proposing from our view. So far from a U-turn, this is more about taking the right highway and not returning on the same highway.
Next question. Question number 224 of 2021. The Honourable Colossal Baldy.
The Speaker, have any teachers been warned or disciplined in respect of their compliance or otherwise with a policy requiring masks in schools since the beginning of the school term in September 2021?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for the Environment and Education.
Mr. Speaker, no teachers have been warned or disciplined in respect to the compliance or otherwise with the policy of requiring masks in schools.
Mr. Speaker, is the Minister aware that if any concerns have been expressed by teachers, either directly to the teaching establishment or through the unions in respect of the policy? And if so, can he provide us with some information as to the nature of the concerns?
Mr. Speaker, there have been no formal processes. There have been informal discussions with, I think it's about 20 members of staff, not all of them teachers, in relation to mask wearing policy. We are through the third week of term, and the matter is being dealt with internally by discussion without the need so far for any formal warning or disciplinary measures.
Mr. Speaker, does the Minister know whether, in respect of those 20 members of staff, are those members of staff scattered around different schools, or is it in a particular school?
I know of at least two schools, it could be more, but I wouldn't like to commit without being able to take those figures. I would not like to mislead the person.
Next question. Question number 210 of 2021. The Honourable E.J. Reilly.
Mr. Speaker, can government provide details of the number of trainees currently enrolled at both the Gibraltar Construction Training Centre and the Engineering Trade Training Centre? Providing details of the estimated completion date of such courses and the qualifications to be obtained upon successful completion of such courses.
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Economic Development and Enterprise.
Mr. Speaker, there are 38 trainees currently enrolled at both with both the construction training centre and the engineering training centre. Estimated completion in 2022, certain NDQ level 2 in building maintenance and 2 NDQ level 2 in plumbing and heating. Estimated completion in 23, 9 NDQ level 2 in building maintenance, 3 NDQ level 2 in plumbing and heating, 1 NDQ level 3 in fabrication and welding, 6 NDQ level 3 in electrical training, 2 NDQ level 3 in mechanical training. Estimated completion in 2024, 2 NDQ level 3 in fabrication and welding, 5 NDQ level 3 in electrical, and 5 NDQ level 3 mechanical.
Next question. Question number 211 of 2021. The Honourable Ms. MD has come now.
When will the Bolsa be able to issue its own 12-sided £1 coin, given the Minister for Economic Development said in 2017 that the Bolsa would be in a position to do so by March 2018?
Answer, the Minister for Economic Development and Enterprise.
Speaker, no decision has been taken yet by the Treasury on the date of the issue of the 12-sided £1 coin.
Mr. Speaker, I understand that the companies who make coin machines, the parking vending machines, parking and vending machines, no longer build machines which accept the old circular coins. For example, the parking machine at the ICC don't accept them either. And we getting into a complicated situation where our Gibraltar pound is, on the one hand, legal tender, but on the other, not accepted, causing difficulty for merchants and general economy in that sense.
Mr. Speaker, the only bit that sounded like a question was, are we getting into a rat situation? The answer is not, as far as I'm concerned.
Mr. Speaker, it was a question. We are running around without coins that are accepted in machines. I would ask again the Minister for Economic Development if this is not a concern, if he wants to try and catalyze the process to ensure that these coins get minted, because it is causing disruption to our machines in the world. And I think that this is an issue which I've had various representations on, and it's a valid issue which I would expect a more substantial answer from the Minister, please.
The honourable question has asked, am I in a position to tell them when it's going to be done? And the answer that I've given is the answer I've got from the Treasury. I haven't yet decided on a date. We've got millions of the existing coins in circulation, and we haven't yet figured out what we do if they all start coming back, which would be a considerable cost to the government. So, I don't have the representation of the honourable member. I've had perhaps. You can tell the people who want to see him to come and see me.
Mr. Speaker, if they do come and see him, is he going to give them the same answer that he's given me and myself as a representative of these people, or will he give them another different answer?
Because the answer they will get is dependent on the person that they ask. And since the honourable member is here, not a somebody that makes a living out of machines, that makes a living out of collecting votes, I imagine it will not necessarily require the same answer.
Speaker, may I just specify, I'm not here to collect votes, I'm here to represent people as I was elected to do. But given that I've asked the Minister in my question, he said that he would be in a position to advise on the minting by 2018. Can you now give us a reason why 3 years later he is not in a position to
and I'm just giving her the information, although probably it was too complex for her to understand. So I will simplify it for her. The 2018 was the point at which the points were expected to be made available to those who wanted the bank, because at the beginning, the United Kingdom Royal Mint was taking all that was being supplied and not allowing any of the overseas territories, those that have coins similar to the UK or the Channel Islands, to use the bank. So the bank was expected to be available from 2018. I don't know whether they were or not since then, but the decision on changing what we're doing here, which will be done when a new set of coins is made for the whole bank of the pound, is dependent on the consideration of the cost involved not in having the coins, but in taking back all the ones that are in circulation. And that decision has been taken by the Treasury. It is not a decision that I will take.
Mr. Speaker, I propose that Madam now adjourn to Thursday, the 23rd of June at 3:30 p.m. in the afternoon, when we should all come back to represent the people of the rest of us and the majority of which decided we should sit here.
I now propose a question which is that this House is now adjourned to Thursday, the 23rd of September. 2021 at 3:30. And I'll put the question, which is that this House is now adjourned to Thursday, the 23rd of September at 3:30. Those in favour, those against, pass. This House is now adjourned to Thursday, the 23rd of September 2021 at 3:30 p.m.